Welcome to this edition of Echo Tones. I'm Joy LeClaire. Perhaps you have heard of the Martel Construction Company headquartered in Bozeman, Montana. Beginning with a spec house in 1960, this family-owned and operated business has become one of Montana's premier general contracting firms. They also specialize in green building, including the LEED Platinum MSU Norm Absjonsen Hall, the LEED Certified Element Hotel, the LEED Silver Bozeman Public Library, and other green-built structures such as Morning Star and Emily Dickinson Elementary Schools, Chief Joseph Middle School, and the Bozeman Yellowstone International Airport. Before their arrival in Bozeman during a wild late spring storm in 1956, however, they had lived through harrowing experiences as refugees fleeing the Red Army from their farmstead in the Ukraine, across Eastern Europe, through separation and reunion in the final year and aftermath of World War II. Their incredible story of that time is brought vividly to life by award-winning local Gallatin Valley writer Mark Sullivan in his latest book, The Last Green Valley. Mark is the best-selling author of 18 previous novels, most recently Beneath a Scarlet Sky, which has sold about 3 million copies and has been translated into dozens of foreign languages, and which was also an astounding true story from World War II. We spoke with Mark Sullivan on April 26, 2021. Welcome to Echo Tones, Mark Sullivan. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, I appreciate being here. Thank you.
Mark, congratulations on the publication of your latest book, The Last Green Valley. It's going to be published by Lake Union on May 4th, 2021, and it follows your tremendously popular Beneath a Scarlet Sky. That book was 10 years in the making, and in a way, it led you to writing The Last Green Valley. Both books share the incredible stories of real live unknown or not well known people caught up in the maelstrom of World War II. As a starting point, remind our listeners of the origin story of Pino Leyla, which you wrote into your Beneath a Scarlet Sky, and how that tale led you to the Martel family story in The Last Green Valley. And I must say that in a way, both of these began right here in Gallatin Valley, since that's where you first heard of these amazing people whose stories you tell so well, right?
That's correct. I heard the story of Pino Leyla in February of 2006 on the worst day of my life. My little brother and best friend had killed himself by drinking himself to death. A book that I wrote that I loved, it tanked in the United States, and my wife and I were in this long, lingering business dispute that took us to the point of personal bankruptcy. And while I was driving down I-90 to Costco, I seriously considered driving into the 7th Street Bridge abutment so my wife could collect on my insurance. I didn't do it, but I got to Costco as rattled as I've ever been in my life, and I put my head on a steering wheel and begged God and the universe for a story. And I get home. My wife has no idea that I've reached this crisis, and she's not feeling well. And she says, you have to go to our friends for dinner tonight. And I said, I'm not going to a dinner party. And she said, you have to. We've canceled on them 3 times. Go for an hour. If you're not feeling it, just excuse yourself and come home. So I go, and 20 minutes into it, a perfect stranger starts telling me the story of Pino Leyla and how this 17-year-old boy had helped Jews escaping Nazi-occupied Italy by guiding them over the Alps into Switzerland during the winter of 43-44. And then through an extraordinary series of circumstances, the same kid becomes a spy inside the German high command. And when I was going around talking about Beneath a Scarlet Sky, a lot of people said, you'll never find another story like it. And I was like, I don't know. I think I will. And sure enough, all these stories started coming out of the woodwork. And a lot of them were really good. A lot of them happened to do with World War II and somebody's relative and what they did. But I really figured out quite quickly that I was going to need a filter. And I came up with why I thought Beneath the Scarlet Sky had touched so many people. And it was because it was inherently moving, inspiring, healing, and potentially transformative to the reader. And I didn't hear that kind of story until November of 17, and I was actually at the Noontime Rotary in Bozeman giving a talk about Pino Lella and the story. And a dentist, Rob Fraser, comes up to me afterwards, and he said, "Do you know the Martells?" And I said, "You mean the construction people here in Bozeman?" And he said, "Yeah." He said, "The entire time I was reading Beneath the Scarlet Sky, all I could think of was the story of how they came to America. You need to hear it." And so a couple of days later, I had Bill Martell's address, and I typed it into my nav, and it was like 2 miles from where I live. And so I drive down, and nav tells me to take a left off Kagi into this older neighborhood. And I'm getting an odd feeling, but I can't quite figure out why until I get to Bill's driveway. And I realize I can't be 200, 250 yards from where I heard Beneath the Scarlet Sky for the first time. And so I was pretty interested in what Bill had to say. And within about 15 minutes of him describing how his family had been forced to run from Stalin in the last year of the war under the protection of the Nazi SS, along with 120,000 other ethnic Germans who were living in Ukraine at the time. And the story, within an hour, I knew I was telling it because it was so inspiring, so moving, and remarkable for what Bill and his brother Walter and his parents went through in about a 2.5-3 year period, last year of the war and the first 2 years after. And I was able to go and retrace their route. They ran with the Germans in a version of a Conestoga wagon with two horses, two little kids, the Soviet army right behind them, and the Germans out in front, and they're caught between the two armies. And it's just an extraordinary story. I have never heard anything like it.
Neither had I until I read The Last Green Valley. Now, any of us can hear an interesting story, but it takes someone special to do the research that you did, to write, and to write it as vividly as you do. And in particular, you excel at writing vivid descriptions of the ravages of war on civilians, and particularly in the early phase of their flight, as you were just saying, when they were caught between the Red Army and the German Army, and those armies have their 20th century weaponry, and the Martells in their horse-drawn wagon with their two little boys. Now, our Gallatin Valley listeners can imagine fleeing in a late March blizzard, but what else did they have to contend with?
Well, they get lost the first day of the trip in a blizzard, in a freak blizzard that comes in, and they get off the road and off the track, and they lose what they called the trek, which was this long line of people fleeing Ukraine. And they hole up and wait for the storm to pass. And when they do, they hear tanks coming from the south, which are the Germans. And Mr. Martell climbs a hill to look for the road. And as he's going up the hill, Soviet tanks come over it, and they're right there between the two forces. And they have to run in the wagon and get the horses to go toward the tanks, which are firing, which is just an extraordinary scene. And when they told me about it, I was just stunned and had to do a lot of research to figure out how to write it correctly. But that's the big challenge of a story like the Martells, is I wasn't interested so much in them telling the story to me and then me reporting it as if I was a journalist. I wanted to bring the story alive. I wanted to have readers go with the Martells on this extraordinary journey.
In my opinion, you have succeeded admirably, as you did in your earlier book, Beneath the Scarlet Sky. Remind our listeners, we've kind of slid over this, what were these ethnic Germans doing there?
Sure. So In the late 1700s, early 1800s, Catherine the Great, who was the Tsarina Empress of Russia, she understood that some of the most fertile land in the world is in Ukraine. It was the breadbasket of Russia. And she understood that the serfs who had the land there were not adept at growing grain, and therefore people in northern Russia were susceptible to starvation. So she went and found the best grain growers at the time, and they were all in Germany. And they were able to bring in big harvests, yields, etc. And so she went and she offered them a remarkable deal. She gave them free land, and she gave them free taxation, no taxation for 30 years, if they would move to the Ukraine and grow grain for Russia. So they did, thousands of them. And they formed these colonies, and they lived largely in isolation, certainly in isolation from Germany for over a century. So they still spoke German among themselves. Their little villages out in the middle of nowhere looked like German villages, but they were completely cut off from Germany. So life was pretty good for the Martels and other ethnic Germans in southern Russia for more than a century, until the Bolshevik Revolution and the rise of Stalinism. And in short order, the world changes, and they're thrown off their land, they're starved, they're persecuted, and this goes on for more than 20 years until Adolf Hitler invades the Soviet Union in June of 1941. And the reason that Hitler does it is he wants a greater Germany, and he understands, just like Catherine the Great did, that Ukraine is a vital source of grain and food and bread. So he attacks and he takes it, and one of the first things they do is they go to the ethnic Germans and say, do you want your land back? And of course they do. So the Martels leave a city where they'd been living, and he was working in a brewery. Then they go back to their ancestral lands, and they have about 18 to 20 months of a good life where they eat and they're not starving and their children are clothed, and life looks pretty good until Stalingrad and the counterattack by the Russians. They drive the Germans off what's called the Dnieper River, and as they do, they come to the ethnic Germans and they say, you have a choice. You can stay and wait for the Soviet bear to return and probably kill you or send you to Siberia, or we're offering you protection and you can run with us and go back to Germany. And so the Martels are faced with this terrible decision, because during the occupation, events happen that cause them to come to despise the Nazis. But they know for a fact that Adeline Martel's father was sent to the mines of Siberia and never returned. Emil Martel's father was sent to the mines of Siberia and came back a broken man. And so they make the decision to run with the Nazis. And what happens is just amazing to me, and remarkable. Again, I'd never heard a story like it, because it's really about the people who are just trying to get out of the way of the war. They're not participating. They're just trying to get out of the way.
Well, as you have sort of alluded to, the chapters alternate with the past. The story begins in March of 1944 as they're leaving their village under German protection. But the chapters alternate with the past under the Soviet Stalinist regime, which was not just cruel, but inexplicably disastrous to its own success.
Yes.
Not only was it disastrous, but it was actually created tremendous famine. And I think you remember how many millions of people died as a result of Joseph Stalin's policies. But that was also paralleled under Maoist China, where untold millions also died of policy-created famines. It wasn't like climate change or drought or anything like that. It was political decisions. This is not a big part of your book, but would you just share with our listeners a bit about that function?
Sure. So in the late 1920s into the early 1930s, there are a number of people in what we call Ukraine now who are actively working against the Soviets. And Stalin can't take this, and he finally decides to crush all opposition in the winter of 1932-33, and he intentionally starves the Ukraine. He withholds food. They have food, but he takes it, commandeers it, puts it out in the sun in big piles while people are starving, and they burn it. And what happens is over the course of about 9 months, 4 million people starve to death in Ukraine. It's devastating. And at the same time, if you weren't starved, you were probably sent, as I said, to the gulag, especially if you were any good at anything or had any ambition to do things. As you said, it was disastrous because it ends up putting the entire Soviet Union in a hard place as far as food, not just the Ukraine, but the Ukraine suffers the worst of it. And it was a way to stifle opposition, pound them.
It seems to me there was also an element of, as you said, anyone who was successful at anything, there was this whole class analysis, and the wealthy peasant was considered an enemy of the state. So if you were good at agriculture, that created at the very least suspicion and all too likely would get you sent to Siberia. Okay, so you go into Adeline's family history and Emil's family history. Both of them had experienced this starvation, which you describe really vividly. Adeline gets a lucky break. Mrs. Cantor hires her as a cook.
Yes.
Tell us about Mrs. Cantor and that scenario and how this introduces into the book the beginnings of how you weave philosophies of life throughout the book.
Yes. Yes. So Adeline, prior to getting hired by Mrs. Cantor, worked in the fields and worked in a brick factory where her job was to step into a vat of mud and straw, et cetera, and mix it all in the cold. And she got very ill, and her sister, Annette, finds her a job with Mrs. Cantor, and she's working as her cook and maid. And she's an older woman who lives in Bursula, Ukraine. And the woman's very kind to her. It's the first, other than her own family, it's the first person who's ever really kind to her and takes a lot of interest in her and talks to her about it. And Mrs. Cantor has a way of seeing the world. She believes in seeing the beauty of every cruelty. She believes in forgiving people for any poor deed because it sets you free. There's a book in the house, and the book is a folio of paintings, and Adeline sees this one painting of this beautiful green valley surrounded by mountains with snow on the peaks and a river running through it. And that becomes her lodestone. That becomes what she's chasing and what she dreams about in life, is to go and live in a place that's beautiful like that. But one of the things I found interesting was that we haven't gotten there yet, but Mr. Martel at a certain point gets grabbed and turned over to the Soviets and sent to right where he doesn't want to go, which is a prison camp. And the brothers agree that before Mr. Martel went into that prison camp, he was very much a person who tried not to get noticed, right? He had figured out that if you were any good, if you had ambition, you were probably going to be sent to Siberia. And he makes a decision that he's going to survive. But the brothers have no idea of how this all came to be, only that he went in a timid person, somebody who tried not to get noticed, and he comes out someone who's highly aware of opportunities and willing to take the risk to achieve them and to have them. And the first risk he takes, of course, is to escape. And he does. And he becomes almost like, I wouldn't say James Bond, but he's pretty impressive at what he does, coming all the way back across Eastern Europe trying to find his family. And so I had to explain that transition. And Bill and Walter said, you know, we don't know. He didn't talk much about the prison camp time other than say it was horrible. And, you know, he watched almost 2,000 people die there before he managed to escape. So I had to figure out how it was going to work and how he was going to have this spiritual transformation. And I met a guy in Barlad, Romania, when I was retracing the trek and he was 98 years old at the time. He was completely lucid. He was one of the more enlightened people I'd ever met. His name was Gheorghe Vasulescu, and he was one of the last survivors of Stalingrad, and he had fought in a famous battle called the Elbow of the Don, which was part of Stalingrad. And he was one of the few Romanians who survived, and he was knocked cold by a mortar bomb and woke up, and he was wounded, head wounded, but he realized, he believed that he would live and that he would not die. And he literally walks through the rest of the Battle of Stalingrad and survives to go back to Romania. And he is there in Barlad when the Martels and the rest of the ethnic Germans come through. He remembered it distinctly. He remembered talking to many of them. And his philosophy on life of how, after he saw them, he was captured by the Soviets, sent to prison camps, escaped from three, ended up in a high security one where he spent 4 years. And he survived the ordeal by holding tight to his dream of being a beekeeper. Mr. Vasulescu became a beekeeper after the war and credited it with his amazing physicality and stamina. He had outlived three wives. He turned 100 last year. He's still going strong. And I decided to make a character like him who would teach Emil to look for opportunities and to have a different perspective on life. And that's what he does.
That brings up a point that this is based on real events, real people, but this, you say, is not narrative nonfiction. It's historical fiction. Would you speak about the differences and why you chose the way you chose?
Sure. Well, the difference is that if you make up one fact, it's no longer nonfiction. It just isn't. It changes the whole thing. But if fiction, if you have a lot of fact in there, it basically supports the story. So my goal in this was to, again, bring the story to life by putting the characters on the shoulders of Emil and Adeline Martel and to tell their story as best I could based on interviews that I'd heard. There were taped interviews with them. There was an article in the Chronicle at one point. They had minor diaries that I was able to go through. But there were still holes, right? Like, how did Mr. Martel manage this incredible transformation under some of the worst conditions you can imagine? And I had to make informed suspicions. And there was several things like that. I'll give you an example. So at one point during my research, I was talking to Adeline's granddaughter, Bill's daughter, who lives in Vail. And she told me that at one point, Adeline told her that shortly after the Martels were given back their land by the Germans, he had to go to a town to get roofing supplies for the house he was building for them. And he was supposed to be gone about a day and a half, and he ends up being gone close to four. And when he gets back, he is shaken and upset as she's ever seen him. And she says, "What happened?" And he said, "Well, I was held by the Nazis and I was forced to bury Jews." So in my research, I had discovered that some of these ethnic Germans at the beginning of the implementation of the Final Solution, which, by the way, started in Ukraine with what was called the Holocaust of Bullets, that many of these ethnic Germans participated. Some of them were the shooters. And later they claimed that they only buried Jews. So I got pretty upset, right? I'm like, oh God, did this happen? And I did enough research to know that the Martels were squeaky clean. I looked in Yad Vashem, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial, everywhere I could, even tracked down a lot of records in the Soviet Union because they had their own trials there post-war. So once I understood that, I did more research and I found an interesting fact. And that was that shortly before the invasion of Russia, the Soviet Union, by the Germans, Heinrich Himmler, who was the head of the SS and the architect of the Final Solution, he intentionally attended a firing squad of political prisoners. And he was so upset that he vomited and he declared that no one will have to kill a Jew unless they want to. No one will be punished if they refuse, because he wanted true believers behind the weapon. In fact, this was true, because during Nuremberg, many of the SS tried to claim that they would have been shot if they had refused to do what Himmler and Hitler wanted. But when the defense attorneys tried to find an example of that, they never could. It didn't exist. And so that played into my hands as a dramatist. And again, I was nervous about writing about these kinds of things, but I finally decided that the only way to deal with it was not to ignore it, but to face it head on. And as a result, the scenes where Emil is taken by the Nazis are among the most dramatic in the book, in my opinion. They're just extraordinary. And they explain a lot of why he was the way he was.
In addition to the facts of their journey, this very loving couple, Emil and Adeline Martel, have a profound difference in their philosophy of life. And
yes,
you explore the eternal questions surrounding things like, is there a God? If so, how can he, she allow cruelty and injustice? Mm. And Adeline has great faith, and it really serves her well. But Emil, and perhaps because of his experience with having to bury the Jews, and actually, I won't give it away, but it's a bit more complicated than that, the way you portray it in the book. And listeners will have to read the book to find out why it was as traumatizing, even more than just burying them. But anyway, yes, Emil's experience has led him to believe that, and I'm quoting, "the only thing we can rely on is ourselves." And this weaves throughout the book with every time something worse and worse and worse happens, and they have to make choices. They have to deal with these questions.
Yes. Yes. I mean, that's what I found interesting, is that when the book starts, Emil has lost his faith. He no longer believes. He believes the only thing he can rely on to get his family to safety is himself. And Adeline does have great faith, but it's interesting is when they are separated, Adeline loses her faith for a while, and he finds it in the gulag, which I found just remarkable. And it creates an amazing dynamic in the story, as you see one person with profound faith lose it and another person who's already lost it find it. And then, of course, Adeline finds it again and never wavers the rest of her life, according to her sons and grandchildren. She was a person of tremendous faith. And he was, too. Emil was a very spiritual person.
Well, back to Mrs. Cantor, who is one of the characters in the book. But she's also a vehicle for Adeline out of poverty, out of starvation, quite literally.
Yes.
And it is through her job at Mrs. Cantor's that she actually meets Emil. She's the cook. He's selling firewood. And anyway, to make a long story short, they fall in love. He asks her to marry him. But this creates a dilemma for Adeline, because she's got a good job. He's a lowly firewood seller. And she asks Mrs. Cantor, who's more than an employer. Mrs. Cantor is a friend as well.
Yes.
I wonder if you would read on page 78 what Mrs. Cantor tells her by way of advice.
Okay. The next morning, Mrs. Cantor noticed her fretting, and Adeline explained her predicament, finishing, "I have it so good here. You're kind to me. We have enough to eat, and you give me a warm place to sleep. What should I do? He collects firewood for a living." Mrs. Cantor gazed at her for several moments before replying, "I shall be heartbroken if you leave, Adelka, but it is better to be a poor wife than a rich maid. You have said Emil is a good man, which means you will know love if you leave me. You will have children if you leave me. You will have a family. And what a family it will be." Her employer had said this last statement with such enthusiasm that she almost knocked over her water glass. This caused Adeline to burst out laughing, which very much pleased Mrs. Cantor. "Keep laughing," she said, wagging a finger at her. "Laughter keeps you young at heart. Laughter at least once a day. Twice is better." "That's easy," Adeline said. "Not always. Can I give you some other advice that has helped me in life?" "Please," Adeline said. Mrs. Cantor waved her to the chair across from her where her friend Esther had sat. Adeline took the chair tentatively, but then smiled at the older woman. "My dear," Mrs. Cantor said, "I have come to believe after 81 years on this earth that our job in life is to endure, to be kind, and to constantly put the past behind us and not dwell too much on the future. If you must look back, trying to find the beauty and the benefit in every cruelty done to you. If you must think about the future, try to have no expectations about it. Trust in God to guide you through. You understand?" Adeline did not understand everything the older woman was saying, but she nodded. "Good," Mrs. Cantor said, "because when you do that, my dear, you will know God's blessing and deserve every happiness and abundance this life has to offer as long as you give part of your abundance to others less fortunate. Do you understand?" Adeline was still not fully grasping what Mrs. Cantor was telling her, but she nodded again. Her uncertainty must have shown in her face because her employer sighed. "I'm trying to give you the keys to a long, happy life, Adeline. Listen again. Our job in life is to endure, to be kind, and to constantly put the past behind us and not dwell too much on the future."
Yes, and that advice serves Adeline well sometimes.
Yes.
In the acknowledgments, Mark Sullivan, you write, "I am blessed to have been taught the principles of the spiritual philosophy of oneness by Krishnaji, Prishadji, and the real Kumarji at O&O Academy in India. That experience informed many parts of this book and changed my life." That brings us back to Corporal Gyorgy and his mentor or teacher, Private Kumar. Let's talk about him a bit more, because he, in some ways, when you first encounter him, he really does seem insane, at the very least delusional. Mm-hmm. But he actually offers the survival advice that allows Emil to escape this death camp and rejoin his family. I especially liked what he said about meditation versus prayer. Can you share with our listeners that?
Yes. Private Gyorgy tells Emil that prayer is where you talk to God and meditation is where you listen. And I just loved that when I first heard it. So I put it in there. And it's true. It's prayer is a beseechment and meditation is a quieting so you can begin to hear what the universe is telling you, what God is telling you. And I did learn that at Meditation Academy in India. I went there on a spiritual retreat about 2 years ago, and it did change my life. They believe that we are all one thing. And of course, at a subatomic level, all physicists will tell you the same thing. It's energy moving back and forth between each other. And once you start to think that way, you no longer are ego-driven. You're no longer care about what it means necessarily to yourself, because you're constantly thinking in what they call one consciousness, which is to try to see always the other person's point of view, because they are part of you and you are part of them.
Now, you have mentioned that after the Soviets take back Poland,
yes,
Emil is captured and sent eastward to this death camp, what turns out to be a death camp, Poltava. And
yes,
his father had been sent to Siberia, and unlike Adeline's father, Emil's father does survive, but as you mentioned, he's a totally broken man.
Yes.
However, he gives Emil advice, not then, but earlier in life, about how one survives circumstances like that. And it's very interesting. I don't know if you want to read that passage or if you just want to describe the advice his father gives him. That's your choice.
So, yeah, Emil's walking with all these other prisoners. As he walked, Emil remembered what his father had told him not long after his return from the frozen East, and one of the few times he'd spoken about his years in a Siberian prison camp, slaving below ground. Emil had asked him how he'd managed to survive. Johann had said some of it was luck and some of it was learned. Despite all his hard work growing up on a farm, for example, Johann was lucky in that he'd been a little chubby from all the good food he'd been eating before the Stalinists came to take him away for hoarding. The extra flab around his belly had allowed him to survive the trip east when so many died. Emil thought about all the food they'd had and how much weight and strength he'd gained since Adeline found Esther. In that way, he was somewhat ready to survive a long journey. He put that in his favor. His father also said that he tried never to speak German in the presence of any of the Soviet soldiers. It seemed to enrage them and often resulted in a beating. Emil decided to speak only Russian from that point forward. Maybe he could convince someone that these two had him all wrong. Johann had said he had trusted very few people in the camps. Everyone at first should be considered a potential informer. Trust should be something hard won. So was the ability to avoid illness. Emil's father had been fanatical about cleaning himself after leaving the mines and latrines. He also forced himself to eat whatever he was given, no matter how grisly, and to drink the cleanest water he could find and lots of it. Quote, the important thing was to stay standing as long as you could, his father had said. Every day you stayed alive, you had the opportunity to be set free or to escape. I escaped twice, but they brought me back and beat me senseless. Then I got sick. That confession had surprised Emil when he first heard it. He had never seen his father as the kind of a man who would try to escape. But now that he was a prisoner himself, he thought he understood Johann at a deeper gut level, better than he ever had before, and he vowed to follow those four survival tactics and others he had heard that day long ago. I can only rely on myself, he thought, but in a sense, my father has prepared me.
Yeah, and in a funny way, and I only just thought of this, I didn't think of it while I was reading, but what he is assigned to do in Poltava, in a curious way, led him to success here in Bozeman. Is that going too far to say that?
I don't think so, because he was always good with his hands. I mean, he had the ability to build his own house, and he actually liked it. He liked building things more than he liked being a farmer or a farmhand. And when he gets to Poltava, this is a city of 300,000 people in far eastern Ukraine, hard by the border of Belarus. And when he gets there, it's in a state of complete ruin. Again, there were 300,000 people who lived there before the war. When he gets there, there are about 5,000, 6,000 left. And they are assigned to rebuild the city. And they start with the city hall, a hospital where Emil works. And he is quickly put to work making bricks in a brick factory kind of thing that he ends up running. And that allows him two things. One is to get inside during the harshest part of the winter. And two, he has the ability to collect scraps of wood, which he ends up selling to the camp cooks to burn, to make food. And so he's able to make money, which is key when he finally escapes. And he also volunteers for the death detail. This was the detail that buried the men who died. And let me say that the Poltava camp was riddled by disease. When Mr. Martel goes in, there are something like 2,300 people. And when he makes his escape, there are about 200 left. There was cholera, dysentery, every possible imagined communicable disease that ravages the place. But he manages to stay alive until he can make his move.
And that is a very exciting tale as well. And as you said, it demonstrates his incredible savviness in being able to elude the manhunt that does follow his escape.
Yes.
We focused on the grown-ups in this story, but they have two little boys when they begin this journey, and they'd actually had a child before these two little boys. But of all things, when she's pregnant, Adeline comes down with malaria. We won't go too far into that, but I would never have imagined that living in the Ukraine, one could get malaria.
You can. In the southern marshes, which is where she was living, it's a marshy area. There's rivers all through Ukraine, and then there are wetlands. And these wetlands were where the mosquitoes, the Anopheles mosquitoes grew. And it was pretty widespread in southern Ukraine at that time. Now, I've had malaria, so I know. And that's why all that rings true, because I'm just describing my own experience.
Aha! Well, that does explain why it was so vivid. As things would happen, On April 23rd, 2021, The Guardian newspaper reported, headline, Oxford malaria vaccine proves highly effective in Burkina Faso trial. And I won't go into it, but it's up to 77% effective in trial over 12 months. So that's not going to help our heroine, Adeline, but for those who suffer, and millions of people die every year of malaria. So this is a serious thing. Back to the boys. Share with our listeners Willie and Walt's experience from their point of view.
Sure. So Walt is 6 and a half when the story starts, and Bill is 4 and a half. And they're two very different people. I've come to know them both very well. And a lot of who they became was created, I think, during this trip. During the tank battle scene, Walt gets terribly upset by, of course, the cannons going off, et cetera. And he's much more introspective. He's a studious person. He ends up, when they get to Montana late in the book, he ends up being the valedictorian of Baker High. But he's also rattled by things. He doesn't like change. And Bill is quite the opposite. He's the second child. He's the sort of devil-may-care person who is very much like Emil in that he wants to build things. And the boys go through what had to be just an incredibly traumatic experience. And they remember parts of it vividly. I mean, they could describe being in the wagon and halfway during the trek across Romania that their wagon was bouncing over bodies of people who had died on the trek and who hadn't been buried yet. And they remembered all this, and it keeps them going in life. So as they grow up, they saw their parents, and they, of course, themselves experienced tremendous hardship and challenge during this journey. And it really sets them up for who they're going to become in life. Walt becomes an architect. Bill becomes a master builder and owns this big construction firm here in Bozeman. But he also learns to give back. He never forgets that, and he does it his whole life. He's still doing it, which is one of the things I really admire about Bill. In my experience, long 40 years of working as a writer and talking to people, it was one of the most emotional things I've ever witnessed, to see them, because there they were, 4 and a half, 6 and a half, running in the middle of a war, and they come back to where they ran from, and you could just see it in their eyes. They were seeing the entire arc of their life right in front of them. And what a miracle it was to understand that two guys from like one of the most rural places I've ever been, parents who were not very educated and yet were fundamentally decent people, and they take these boys on this journey, and it came full circle. So the crucible of the journey changes them all. And it was up to me to basically write it in a way that the reader sees the change and also sees the constancy of who they are. Because there's certain things that just never change about us unless there's, you know, some kind of crisis late in life or something. But for the most part, our personalities are set young. And that journey really helped define their personalities in my mind.
You dedicate the book for all the grateful refugees who renew this nation every day, and not just in this country, but in many different parts of the world, millions of people are in the situation of being refugees, whether they're fleeing war or climate change, religious oppression. It's just a fact of life nowadays. Were you thinking of that when you were writing?
I was. I was thinking because, you know, I wrote down before I started writing, very late in the research process. We were at the airport in Kiev and waiting. Walt and I were waiting for flights to Berlin because we were going to go retrace Adeline's escape route. And Bill was leaving to go back to the States. And I'd been really thinking about it. I just couldn't, having been to the ruins of the farmhouse where they start the book And having been to the museum, the bombed out museum where Emil was held and slept in the prison camp, I was really starting to understand at a deep gut level how remarkable it was that they actually got to America, that this dream of freedom, of living in a green valley with mountains all around and a river running through it, comes true. And because of that, and because of their experience at having to work so hard and so long just to survive, when they get to the United States, they do the same thing. They work just as hard. And for the first time in their life, they get the results out of it. And quite literally, from that point forward, from the time they get to Bozeman forward, like everything they touch turns to gold. It's extraordinary. And they have a profound impact on Bozeman and the people of Bozeman and the people of Montana. And I really thought about that. And I wrote down the words I actually used to end the book. I put them down in my notebook right at that time. And I'll read it to you. And I wrote down, "This is an American story, an immigrant story, a spiritual and universal story. May we all dare to chase such dreams, experience such grace, and lead such miraculous lives."
Well, it's hard to follow that. I mean, it's very profound. That brings us to an epigram at the beginning of the book from Chen Yang. "With love in our hearts, there is nothing we cannot overcome." They're living proof of that, because, boy, did they have a lot to overcome.
Now, amazing.
Mark, you did allude to your 40 years of investigative reporting, writing. How many books is it now? 18, is it?
It's 19 now.
This 19 books. Yeah. I found it very interesting that as soon as you left college, you joined the Peace Corps and went to Niger. And I can't help thinking that that must have had some influence on your perceptions that led you to this, your latest book. First of all, am I right? And second of all, if so, how so?
Well, certainly, I mean, going to the Peace Corps, I went from living in suburban Boston, where I grew up, to the second poorest country on earth at the time. And it was, frankly, a gigantic dope slap. I mean, I was aware that people lived in poverty, but I never knew that people lived so close to the subsistence level. And they became, their children became my students. I was a teacher there in a place called Agadez, which is on the ancient caravan route between Tripoli and Timbuktu. And I really got an education on what it was to see the other person's point of view. And that has given me just an amazing insight my whole career, because I was constantly more interested in what other people had to say than what I had to say. And that carried through to this story. My job is to research it, write it well, but effectively disappear. I don't want readers to think about the writer at all. It's my job to vanish and just let the story happen. The Africa experience was fundamental in making me understand that there was a gigantic world out there full of stories, and I wanted to go out and tell them. I wanted to find them, and I wanted to tell them. And also, I got malaria while I was in the Peace Corps, so that helped me too. It helped me really understand what Adeline had to have gone through.
You have chosen to publish both this book, The Last Green Valley, and Beneath a Scarlet Sky with Lake Union Publishing. I wonder if you could share with our listeners what went into your deciding to go that route.
Sure. We should also say that Lake Union Publishing is owned by Amazon under their Amazon Publishing Group. Part of it was that 12 houses in New York turned down Beneath a Scarlet Sky. And my oldest son, who is also a novelist, Connor Sullivan, who has his first book coming out in July called The Sleeping Bear, he said, "Dad, I honestly think you should go to Amazon, because your goal for Beneath a Scarlet Sky was to impact as many people as possible." And that was true. I came back from Italy a fundamentally different person. The book has sold close to 3 million copies. It's been published in 37 languages. It's going to be a 7-part miniseries starring Tom Holland. And all those things are fantastic. But the thing that means the most to me are the letters that I get from people who are profoundly depressed and or suicidal when they pick up the book. And they write me that it changed their lives as the story changed my life. So that is a massive factor right there, is that I, prior to Beneath the Scarlet Sky, I wrote mystery and suspense novels, which are primarily an intellectual exercise, right? I'm creating a puzzle. I'm creating an event for, or a series of circumstances for readers to go through until they figure out the puzzle. This book and Beneath the Scarlet Sky were fundamentally different. I had to write them from the heart, which is a very different thing. You have to be completely in understanding that when you're writing well, you're not even cognizant of who you are or what you are. And at the same time, you're constantly aware of the emotional state of the characters. I find it baffling that you read in a lot of book reviews or something that I just read one the other day. It says something like a magnificent, unsentimental love story. And I went, unsentimental? Well, I guess they missed the point, because I've never heard of love that wasn't sentimental. And people have lost track of that. And people want to understand what people go through. And by describing their emotional state and where they are on the arc of their emotional journey, you're able to suck in readers. And that's what I want. I want them to engage, to believe that they are the Martells while they're reading the book, as I wanted people to believe that they were Pino Lella in the book.
I am curious. I've read that it took you 10 years to write Beneath the Scarlet Sky, and yet you were able to write The Last Green Valley relatively quickly. Is there any accounting for that, or what can you say?
Well, I had to write 9 other books while I was researching and writing Beneath, so yeah.
Oh, I see.
I had to make a living while I was trying to work on my passion project, because that's really what it was. I never set out to write it to make money or any of that. I just wanted people to know Pino Lella's story. And unfortunately, you know, I didn't speak Italian. I didn't speak German. I had to do extensive research in the German war archives, things like that. So I would save up money, and then I would hire translators, guides, to meet me in Germany or Italy or wherever. And I kept going back, and it just took that long to basically teach myself the story and then to learn how to be a better writer in order to tell the story correctly. That's why it took that long.
In both those books, both those stories, the individuals are caught in, to be cliche, between rocks and hard places constantly. There are no what you would consider good choices. There's only like the lesser of two bad choices. And that's the human situation, at least sometimes. And I think that that's one of the reasons that your books do speak to people, because that's the lived experience. Not as drastically as being in World War II with the Nazis about to kill you if you do the wrong thing. But yeah, people don't always have good choices, but they have to make them.
Right. And that is the human condition. And that's what I was interested in writing about. This is a universal story, because we may not be subjected to the extremes that the Martells and Pino Lella were, but we will be forced into situations that are difficult, that demand difficult decisions, and there won't be an easy decision involved. And that's part of being human. But also part of being human is seeing love triumph. And that's ultimately what I wanted to do with these stories, is tell stories of tremendous ordeal and tremendous triumph, because that's certainly what happens to the Martells when they get here.
Are there any other passages that you would like to read before we close this interview, Mark Sullivan?
Near the end of the book, someone asks Adeline what she'd learned from her life. And she said, "You know, I used to think life was something that happened to me," she told one friend as she was beginning to fail. "But now I know life happened for me." They were out in her garden, and she was smiling at how it teemed with life. Looking back, Adeline said she could see the entire incredible arc of her journey, how everything that happened to her and Emil had indeed seemed to prepare them for the next, more difficult challenge, both of them learning and adapting the entire way. More than 50 years had passed since she and the boys escaped the Soviet occupation zone and reunited with Emil, but she still marveled at the events of that day. If that old woman had given us water from her well, we never would have been warned by the man driving the milk wagon to hide in the shed, and we probably would have walked right into the Soviet patrol, she said. And if we hadn't gone for the border when we did, so close to the patrol passing with the prisoners, the Soviet soldiers in the guardhouse would not have thought we had the correct documents to cross the border and would not have sent that muddy angel of a man to help us get the wagon to the train station. The border guards would have stopped us, and who knows what would have happened. After marveling over her story, her friend asked Adeline to describe the most remarkable things she'd learned over the course of her long and remarkable life. Adeline thought about that for a while before saying, "Don't chew on the bad things that happened to you, dear. Try to see the beauty in every cruelty. It sets you free. Forgive hurt if you want to heal a broken heart. Try to be grateful for every setback or tragedy, because by living through them, you become stronger. I see the hand of God in that. I also see his hand in every right step and every wrong one we took in our lives, all somehow moving us forward, but sometimes around and around and around, like a leaf I've always remembered seeing blowing in the wind the first day of the long trek. We were blown along like that leaf, dancing, spinning, and rolling towards this life we were dreaming of. And here I am so many years later, still living that dream. It really is a miracle, isn't it? And now the only miracle left for me is to die and be taken in the arms of God."
Mark Sullivan, thank you so much for joining us today on Echo Tones and for writing this beautiful book, The Last Green Valley, and it's being published by Lake Union on May 4th, 2021. Any final words for our listeners?
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about the Martells and Pinot Lella, so thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Mark Sullivan. You have just heard an interview with award-winning Gallatin Valley author Mark Sullivan about his latest book, The Last Green Valley. An ecotone is a transition zone between two biomes. It is where two communities meet and integrate. This radio program, Ecotones, explores the variety and diversity of the Greater Gallatin Valley community and beyond, offering audio echoing tones as our communities influence and are influenced by each other, bridging limits and boundaries and celebrating diversity. Echo Tones is a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LaClaire in Bozeman, Montana, for broadcast and archiving on KGVM Bozeman and KGVM.org. Till next time, this is Joy LaClaire, signing out for now.